Welcome to the Voices of the West, hosted by Emil Franzi and dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
Hi there! Welcome to Voices of the West. Improvisational shows. We actually do better with these, you know that? Yeah, you watched this before. Well, we didn't get what we thought we were going to get, so we're going to go... And I'll tell you what the deal is. And anybody, this is for all of you. I really want your feedback, audience. Hang in. Because if you're an audience of this show, you have obviously paid attention to, there's at least three different versions of Western history stuff being flowed through.
Minimum.
Television right now. One of them is the Bill O'Reilly stuff, which is, one of them, there's another one the History Channel's done. I believe. And then there's this Robert Redford stuff. Now, we didn't watch any of it. What we did was we
and kind of a fourth, because PBS periodically runs the same documentaries over and over
and
over.
Yeah, that's true. Some of that's just been there for a while. So anyhow, you've got the Robert Redford stuff. So we started to watch it night before last. And, you know, we did the old binge thing, or started to do the old binge thing, except I couldn't handle it for that long. Anyway, we ran about 3 hours worth of it, and I gotta tell you this. I have never seen worse crap from production over. First off, it was borderline incoherent, if you knew anything at all about the history of anything. I mean, I think they sort of got it on the right continent, but I'm not too sure. But it was incoherently done. And I'm just going to pick out one part of this for openers, and that is handling the entire Native American thing. And they seem to have the following supposition that after the Civil War, which is this big violent thing that went on, all these guys were going to, white folks, were going to come west, and there were these things called Indians there. Good, yeah, all right, I'm still with it. And they spent just about all their time devoted to the problems with the Sioux, because they had to spend all their time on two people, Custer and Crazy Horse. Now, I don't have to tell you all this, but any historian... Bush League historian knows that it was a whole lot more relevant than that. And then they had General Grant in charge, who quit being General Grant in 1868 when he became President Grant. But it was real hard because the chronology was mushier than hell, so you couldn't tell what they were doing. They were bouncing back and forth.
Kind of a comic book version of the American
West. It wasn't even
that
good. The problem I have with them is here's Grant running around with four stars. I know how to tell you this. He didn't have four stars.
No.
He had three. I know how to tell you this. They had one point it looked like Sherman with four stars. Because they'd get Sherman in their center. The guy could
that
find...
That didn't start till World War II, right?
World War One. Okay. Four stars by then. There was the title General, and Grant had it, so he might have at some point been entitled to four. I agree with... I'm not going to argue about it. But that isn't how Grant dressed anyway, but that's a Mickey Mouse. The other problem they had was they couldn't make up their mind what guns to use. And it wasn't that they couldn't afford all the different, apparently they couldn't afford all the different models. It was that they just didn't know which ones belong where, or you wouldn't have had one guy with a muzzle-loading rifle and a Colt 73, okay? The most pathetic part of this was those of us who know a little bit about the history of the Sioux Nation and its wars with America, in 1866, and this whole thing was about one character, Crazy Horse, right? Okay, so it's how Crazy Horse figured out how to take down the army, see? And they had this incident up there where they had about almost 100 American troops were killed, and they made the point that they had muzzle loaders. I would also point out they had a pair of revolvers each. So this wasn't going to go the way they did it, where they had the Indians lay in the bush and then suddenly charge after they'd fired one bat that all shot their rifles at Crazy Horse that was dragging back and forth in front of them. I'm going, that's got to be the biggest piece of BS I ever saw in my life. Can we talk about what really happened? It was called the Fetterman Massacre. It occurred because the What was the fort? Hang on, Terry. Anyway, the Fort Phil Kearny. And it was Fort Phil Kearny where you had a cocky officer named Fetterman who said, give me 80 men and I can ride for the whole Sioux Nation. And the Sioux, under a guy named Red Cloud, who they never bothered to mention, yeah, who just happened to be the Indian in charge. And all Crazy Horse was you know, a pretty good little warrior at the time. And he bagged Fetterman when Fetterman's guys were sucked into chasing. They got this part right.
Yeah.
Dumb gringos chased into trap by smart Indians. Okay, they got that part. You know, it stopped right about there on reality.
That tactic goes back to Hannibal.
Duh. Anyway, they sucked Fetterman in, and they killed 78 people. They never mentioned Fetterman's name. They never called it that. They never mentioned Red Cloud, and they never pointed out that it was all about Fort Phil Kearny, and that the biggest victory ever achieved over the American military by an Indian force was when they finally gave up, burned down Fort Phil Kearny, and left. And ended the whole problem and made a treaty to Red Cloud's liking, which they, of course, double-crossed him on later, and double-crossed that wing of the Lakota. But it had absolutely no resemblance to reality. I would point out to you, for those of you who wish to know the real facts, The Heart of Everything That Is, The Untold Story of Red Cloud, an American Legend by Bob Drury and Tom Clavin. And if you look up the archives of Voices of the West, you'll find an hour-long interview with him.
I may be wrong, but if I remember right, well, one of the things that Red Cloud did was the fort had sent out a woodcutting party. And they attacked the woodcutting party, pinned it down, and let a rider get back to the fort to alert them that they were pinned down. And then that's when they came out.
That was another time.
Yeah. Oh, that's another one.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that was another one. Now, what happened right about then is they converted from muzzle loaders to breech loaders. All right, I'm going to take a call from Terry before I go on to 14 other blunders these morons are making. Hi, Terry.
Hey, I just want to thank you for being factual, and that's great. And then I'll take the question off the air, but I'm heading over to Silver City area, and I understand there's some real good historical things like Fort Baird over there. So anything you might help me with that, the email, I'd appreciate it. I've been listening a long time.
Oh, Terry, let me defer to my native New Mexican sitting next to me here with Bunker.
Oh, more awesome. Thanks again, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, what was the question exactly?
What's going on in Silver City? You can go look for it while he's there. It's a whole lot.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things is Silver City, that was up in where the Gila Wilderness was, and until early day mining is what put Silver City on the map, but what really established and continued it was the farming and agriculture to the east and south of there. Now, as far as the Indian situation over there, the Apache were in and out of the area, and that was kind of a breadbasket for them. But I can't think of any encounters, and I may be lacking in that area, but I can't think of any encounters, major or minor, between the U.S. and the Apache in that area.
There had to be some.
Well, I'm sure there was.
But, I mean, you know, there were. You'd have to go back and research the Army records, because usually you run into an Apache where five Apaches and six soldiers.
Yeah.
Okay, it was one of those kind of a deal.
And one of the things too is that that area, it was the majority of the population in that area was Hispanic. You know, it was from the early Spaniards that came over in the late 1500s, and the real center of activity in that area was Mesilla down to the south towards El Paso. And even Mesilla, to my knowledge, never had any major Apache problem. And you'd have to think, because Silver City lies pretty much between the Mescalero and the Chiricahua.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you'd think there would be. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's pretty rugged country, too. And again, you know, the Anglos that came into that area, they were staying close to the rivers and the valleys. And the Apache, you know, if you're not bothering them, they would go around you. If you were a problem, they took you out.
Yeah, that's true. All right, I'm going to do two more of these. The Snake Conflict, 1864-1868, the deadliest Indian war in the West, by a guy named Greg Minchinone. There were more troops and militia killed fighting Indians in the Snake River area in that 4-year period than in the rest of the Indian wars combined.
The Modoc Wars.
And it was very simple. It was because that was such terrible country that they the Indians only lived in bands of about 30. There was no centralized way you could ever make peace with them. And they were hungry, and they were nasty, and they were mean. And they'd bag you here, and they'd steal you from you there, and all these tiny little engagements. And we lost troop after troop after troop, and it took about 4 years to settle them down. That was would be in the area Oregon, Northern California, Idaho, Nevada.
It was all volcanic country.
Oh, terrible country.
And, you know, the thing, too, is the military leadership was pretty much inept and incompetent, and they were having constant conflict with the civilians in the area because they were waging the war along with the military side by side, and they couldn't get any cooperation.
That's part of it. The other problem I had is they devoted all this time to acting like it was Whitey versus the Sioux. Apparently, they missed the Comanche along the way. Okay, I have in my hand three books: War of a Thousand Deserts by Brian DeLay, Comanche Empire by Pekka Hämäläinen, and Empire of the Summer Moon by S.C. Gwynn. Bingo. And let me tell you what. There was no such thing as Aztlan. There was Comancheria, dingbats. Mm-hmm. And the Comanche were much more powerful, and even a bigger empire than the Sioux were to the north. And whoever was making this bozo operation for Redford didn't even know it.
You know, there's an interesting footnote to Sioux history. A lot of people don't realize, you know, the Sioux are up in Wisconsin and Minnesota and that country.
Yeah,
and
the eastern Mississippi branch.
Well, the Anishinaabe drove them out of that part of the country into the plains, and they never came back.
All right, hang on, everybody. I'm going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with Scott Dyke and talk about, maybe we'll take a fast call from Gloria when we get back, and then go to Scott Dyke and have a chat about it. I believe there's some also problems with their Wyatt Earp coverage.
Yes.
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
Hi there, welcome back. Okay, now that we've pretty well destroyed their Indian coverage, Scott, hang on, I'm going to take a call from Gloria. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, Gloria?
Call from Gloria. Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
We got Scott?
Yeah, today is the anniversary of the August 27th La Mesilla election riots in 1871. And something like 8 or 9 people were killed, including the Republican candidate for the judgeship of the area, and 50 people wounded. It was bigger by far than the OK Corral.
Huh. And who was the major protagonist in that?
The Republicans and Democrats both had rallies in La Mesilla. If you Google La Mesilla riots, they both had bands. And a Democratic guy whacked the Republican candidate with a axe handle or a wheel spoke or something and started a riot. And everybody pulled their guns and started shooting.
Now, recognize, I believe what we do is we recognize that the Republicans were the Union guys.
Right.
And the Democrats were the Southern guys, and this was Civil War hangover time.
Correct.
Yeah, that was the real cause of it. It was actually, if you want to look at the OK Corral and look at a lot of the stuff in Tombstone, he had that
same
factor going
too.
Yep.
And
okay, this is Ted. I don't know what happened to Gloria. Just let me make sure. Obviously, okay. You're not Gloria, Ted, so we got that part.
I thought maybe it might have been my wife. Her family was there. And they all skedaddled to Chihuahua.
Well, I heard about that. Yes.
Hey, Ted, could you call this one of the first Battle of the Bands?
It's called Battle of the Bands also. It's
for it. All right. Thank you. That's interesting. Alamo Sea Riots. I got to look that up.
Okay.
And I will.
Wonderful story. Yeah.
Great stories in that area.
Thank you, my friend. All right. Now we're going to go talk about another aspect of the Robert Redford for Lunch Bunch with our good friend Scott Dyke. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Mo. How are you?
Well, not lacking in subject matter for now, I can tell you that. Now, I had not seen, I looked upon it with fear and trepidation and never went back for it, but it's still sitting there and somewhere inside that little box beneath my TV set, and that's the Wyatt Earp portion of the Robert Redford presentation. If it was half as miserable as the Indians, it sucked. Tell us about it.
I would say four times as miserable.
Oh, that's bad.
Well, did they put it Monument Valley?
Well, I mean, when they start with introducing Wyatt as the deputy sheriff as he goes down the street to for the gunfight, you know, and then it just goes downhill from there. I'm surprised that Redford, I know he wasn't much of an actor. He got carried by heavyweights all his life, including Paul Newman to start with and Butch Cassidy, but really, you know, this was something that shouldn't have been done.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that hurts a lot of these so-called documentaries is that they don't, you know, the reenactors, there's just something about the people, they don't convey the person they're supposed to be portraying. They just look like some guy, and not to put down Tombstone Street Fighters, but they look like these guys that go down there and shooting each other and fall on the ground. They don't look convincing. They don't look historical. And they don't convey the story that they're trying to convey, even if it's a badly told story.
So
I can buy into that, but the storyline is all very flawed. There's a couple of guys interviewed in this. One guy wrote one book a couple of years ago. His name was Eisenberg. I don't know who he talked to, but the book was so terrible I couldn't even get through it. And then you had Jeff Morey, who is a recognized expert, and I trade emails with Jeff, and he quite was very frankly embarrassed by the presentation because he interviews these people all in segments, and nobody knew what the content was, you know. So when they put it all together, they're saying, what? And then Ann Kirshner, who wrote Lady at the OK Corral, a nice lady. I helped her with her book. And that's fine, but, you know, Ann doesn't know anything about Wyatt Earp. She was specialized in Josie and did a lot of research, and good research about her. But these people cobble together people that just don't know anything about anything, and it's really amazing.
Well, I was frightened when I saw Paul Hutton flash by, but he was only
he tunes into everything.
Paul's yes, but he was only
a media star in this venue.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I know he really likes being on camera. And I can think of a couple more that do the same, but he was only on for about six words.
Mm. And he didn't say anything wrong either.
I'm sure he didn't.
But he's always one of the go-to guys. These people go to the same people over and over again, or new people. I mean, not to pick on Eisenberg, but, you know, he didn't talk to the right people. His book was a throw-up kind of operation, and it's like, what are you doing with him? Because he wrote the last book, you're going to go to him? I mean,
yeah, but even on those, you'd think he could at least get a few of the basics down, like, gee whiz, who was actually there at the corral? I mean, the deputy sheriff shtick Wyatt is inexcusable.
Well, with a confrontation, you know, there's so many errors, it's like, they got Wyatt saying, give up your guns. Well, no, Virgil said that because Wyatt was not Virgil was the town marshal. He was in charge of the operation. And he's the one that said, give up your guns. Everybody knew that by all the transcripts and the trials and everything. And how can you get that wrong, you know? And they got horses in a corral behind them. You know, no, that's not. It was an empty lot. There was a couple of horses there that the Cowboys had.
You know, I think one of the problems with these these documentaries is I spent 30 years in the picture business. I worked both sides of the camera, production and stunts on the other side. And one of the problems is that production doesn't really care about content. What they're more concerned with is bottom line cost. And when they're putting something together, they do just like you said, Scott. They go to the last guy they talk to or the last guy somebody else talked to, and they have the same talking heads over and over again, and they never vet these guys for their accuracy or the material that they're quoting.
Well, that's well said. And it's like the Earps went to a Tombstone to mine silver. No, they didn't go to mine silver. They went to run a stage line. They found three there, so they decided to do something. And the fallback position, what three or four of them always did, was to be law enforcement officers and let's run feral games.
And partnership in a couple of saloons.
Contracts. And the bottom line is, who am I talking, Bunker, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, Bunker. The bottom line is, it doesn't take any effort to get it right.
No.
Right.
That's the thing that gets, like the movies. The actual story is actually bloodier and more exciting than what the movies do. So why do they have to bastardize it? I have no idea. But, you know, we've been down this road so many times, and Emil and I have talked so many times. But, you know, getting back to this thing, here's my upshot. I was contacted about a year or two ago about doing a documentary, and it may well have been this one. And they went through all the spiel and everything, and I said, okay, how much? How much what? How much will you pay me? Oh, we don't pay anything.
Yep, that's it.
I said, well, thank you and goodbye. So what do they get? They get a bunch of people that are trying to sell a book, or they're trying to get their face on TV for their own glory. You know, that's it. And
precisely.
When you go that route, you're getting a lesser product.
Thank you.
You said it well.
That was pretty blunt. What?
Yeah, no, it is.
It's the truth.
It's called, excuse me, what am I supposed to do this for? Well, the glory of letting us put you on television.
Yeah, well, you know, big deal.
Well, you know, and the other thing, too, is, you know, there's been so much, so many books, articles, newspaper pieces on this thing that, and there's so many different opinions and views. And one of the things is somebody new coming to it that wants to write about it, he looks at everything, and then he picks and chooses what he wants to tell his story, and then he looks for something that's just a little bit different so that he has a reason to publish this, because everybody's going to rush out and buy it because it's Wyatt Earp.
It's funny. Getting back to the Redford production, one of the huge errors, of which there are many, I forget even who made a comment about, well, the killing of Stillwell up in Tucson, the train station, when Wyatt was sending off his dead brother Morgan and his injured brother Virgil, was premeditated. Are you kidding?
Mm-mm.
They went up there and Stillwell and Ike Clanton were there. You know, that wasn't premeditated. These guys were there trying to pick them off. I mean, anybody who's made any kind of primeval study of this stuff would say, where do you come up with these crazy ideas, premeditated? Like, Ike was there, but Wyatt hunted him down. Hell, Wyatt didn't even know he was there.
They don't want to pay guys like you to be on the tube, but how much do they pay the morons who write this crap?
Well, I would have the faintest idea. Whatever it is too much.
Well, I'm going to throw something out. Think about this, because we're talking about the Redford connection. One of the things that happens is a lot of times vanity gets caught up in this. And Redford, you know, he's an environmentalist, and he that whole movement and everything. But at the same time, his name is a selling thing, and people go to him and say, hey, this is a great project, and it'll really make you look good. Part
well,
of your legacy.
I tell you what, if I was Selleck and I was some of the other first stringers that they had do little blurbs at the beginning of the one I saw, I'd be embarrassed.
Yeah,
I wouldn't want to. If I was had their success story in their profession, I would be real careful about putting my. In other words, when you get all done, let me see it before I okay it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that would be.
And
harsh.
Usually Selleck does, because I can tell you a long story about a movie called Monty Walsh, but we'll get there later. Hey, Scott, hang on. We're going to grab a break and come back, and then we're going to try. Did you get a chance to watch any of the Custer crap?
Yeah, I did.
So did I. We can have some fun with that one. Let's go. All right.
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
Hi there, welcome back. We're doing a number on Robert Redford's, of all the Mickey Mouse ones I've seen, guys, this one was the worst. Anyway, Scott Dyke, let's chat about the Custer version of this a little bit. He was not Grant's favorite general. He was Sheridan's.
Well, Sheridan's the one that defended him. Got him back into play, of course.
And the, as I'm watching this, and it's almost incoherent, they go back and forth. I could never find any mention of Sheridan. Could you?
Well no.
It's like he wasn't there. Well, the whole Indian War was Grant and Custer versus Sitting Bull, and he got it.
And Grant's back in Washington.
Yeah, to be honest with you, when I got to that segment, I couldn't stomach no more. So I didn't get through it all. And I had to go through Wyatt and Tombstone and beat Billy the Kid.
You were beaten down by them.
Oh, I didn't do Billy the Kid.
Well, I think Billy the Kid was the topper for me. First of all, they have the characterizations, like Bunker referred to earlier, that could have been better. Like Garrett was like 6'5", right? And they got him portrayed like at 5'10". Okay. You get a pass on this one. But you got Billy the Kid with a beard.
Hell, never.
He probably couldn't even grow a beard.
Never.
That was horse pucky, to quote Wilford Brimley. And then you got these other silly things like Billy Kid, Bell takes his handcuffs off in Lincoln inside the jail. No, he was going to the outhouse, you know. It's like, I mean, good Lord, can't you get that part right? And there's a guy that I know not very well, but he's a historian. I can't say we're close friends or anything. We've discussed things back and forth. His name is Drew Gomber.
I know.
Yeah, okay.
He's probably one of the best with the Billy Kid story. He lives in Lincoln, by the way. And he does all the historical things. And that'd be the first guy I would go to, you know. I'm not saying I'm a Drew Gomber fan, but hey, you know, I mean, the guy's been there for 30 years doing this stuff and researching and doing it. It's just like, maybe he did, but and I wouldn't doubt it did what I did. It's like, how much are you going to pay me?
Well, you know? I'm sure he did, because I asked him to do something one time, and he said, what are you paying me for this?
Yeah, goodbye.
Yeah, right. You know, okay, I get that, no problem.
Not to get off of this, but for a second, but Scott, did you ever read any of the stuff that Gomber wrote about Quantrill?
No.
Very interesting stuff.
No, is it? Okay.
Very interesting.
But it doesn't mean he isn't a reliable guy. Also, when in doubt on Billy the Kid, actually, Boggs isn't too easy to trip over, you know?
Well, you know, I grew up in Lincoln County in Rio Doce.
And he has so many books out there, he'd be happy to you know, he's one of those guys you can get to do a freebie simply because, I'm not speaking for Johnny out of turn here, when he got 42 books in print, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Well, he's a good guy, and he's managed to traverse the waters of controversy for years.
Yes,
I give him credit for that.
And do it with honor.
Well, here's
by the way, I try to throw this in. It's not really relevant, but I had an author from San Bernardino, California, come in about the Earps, and I took him down, and we hooked up with Bed Trawick. He said to say hello to you. I said, I'm going to talk to Emil sometime in the near future, and so Ben said to say hi.
Who just
turned 89 last week.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, so, of course, for those that don't know Ben, he's the Tombstone Historian Emeritus of 45 years down there. So, you know, and has written, like, I don't know, 40 books and God knows how many other stuff. An incredible source for media. And And, like, why wouldn't you talk to him about Wyatt Earp, too?
Yeah.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a thing about Billy the Kid over home there when we talk about him, is that a lot of people believe, because, you know, he was of small stature and that his hands were so small that some people actually believe that he slipped the handcuffs when he was making that. That's partially how he was able to get the gun.
Well, that's the story that's been out there for some time about the you know,
whether it's true or not, I don't know, but that's over home, that's what they believe.
Small hands, you know, that was the deal, supposedly. But it happened in the outhouse. Who planted the gun? Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Whether he got it there, who knows? Chances are it's pretty good. But it didn't happen when the guy took the cuffs off him in the middle of his jail cell.
Thank you.
That was just preposterous. I've been there. I've seen the cell. They still have it. It was the old Murphy store, and they turned it into, you know, in that era as a jail and whatnot. And it's like, you know, I mean, you get it right. You know what I'm saying? Just please.
Yeah, how hard is
it?
You can give it to a 12th grader and say, write this up as a term paper. How hard would it be?
Well, as long
probably
as
wouldn't have to pay the kid either.
As long as they didn't watch the Redford, they'd probably get a good paper.
Bingo. All right, let's go to Linda.
Hello, my friend. We watched that series, too. Jim and I sat here and said, you know, I think we could have written this better than they did. How did you like Jesse James coming out to New Mexico to recruit Billy the Kid?
Never happened.
I know. But I also wanted to make the comparison. I thought at least that was called The American West, and it's on AMC. The Robert Redford one. And, of course, the Legends and Lies one, I have never seen such poor costuming, and the wigs for the Patriots were they distracted me so much I couldn't hardly even watch the story. Your friend there who does the movies, I think, would understand
Yes. What
a difference it makes when the guns are right and when the clothing is right and when if they're supposed to wear wigs, then don't make them look like they just came in from a hippie party somewhere.
There's a big difference between enthusiasm and trying to do something and actually doing it right.
Right. I'm really glad you're talking about this, because as we watch the American West Robert Redford thing, we both looked at each other and said, when did we ever hear of Jesse James coming to recruit Billy the Kid in New Mexico?
He never had problem recruiting. They had every two-bit gunsel in the East wanting to join up with him.
Well, and you know the problem is that people sit here and watch that and they think, oh, my gosh, I never heard this. It must be true.
Yeah.
So thank you, Emil. I'll listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Yeah, well, that's one of the problems here. And one of the other problems is...
I actually thought Billy the Kid was part of Mob Barker's gang, but hey.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. Bonnie and Clyde, maybe.
One of the problems we have with this is, and it's the same thing, and I always got to do it. I always get around to comparing the horse operas with the Italian operas, because both fans of both have the same problem. They're desperate. Because, for no good reason, because the archive is so deep, you don't need to be desperate. But we are so prone to wanting something. Oh, it's a Western. Oh, boy, oh, boy.
We're trapped in the stereotypes,
that
too.
That we're better off, that we don't want to attack it, because we've got this somehow feeling that getting it all that wrong, sooner or later we'll be able to straighten it out later. Now, it is one thing to take a movie like Tombstone, Scott, which you and I have both done in front of groups, and say, okay, now here's the movie, here's what it got wrong. But next to some of this other crap, Tombstone is a documentary.
And think about it, Tombstone,
okay.
And it wasn't made to be a documentary, it was made to be an entertainment.
Bingo. And the entertainment sometimes is more accurate than the supposed historical stuff. I mean, to put the label of something real on this is just, it's beyond me. We never did get to Custer, did we? Hang on, we're going to take a break and come back.
I think he hung out with Ike Clanton.
Yeah.
Okay, hang on. Thank you.
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
And so getting back to the Custer version of the Redford Follies, apparently there was only one general that fought Indians, and that was Custer, because I saw no mention whatsoever of Terry or Crook or Miles or even Sheridan, okay?
Yeah, interesting. He was a colonel at the time, but that's okay. Yeah.
Well, they didn't pass over that, and they had them wearing general stars, too. By the way, they had all the rank badges were all wrong. And the guns were all wrong. And there's no excuse for that. With today's supply of repros, you can equip anybody with anything. And I don't think they were saving money, because I saw all kinds of people just running around with the wrong gun when all they had to do was trade them out for the next batch.
Well, you know, when they use reenactors, a lot of times they tell them, bring your own gun.
Actually, you'd probably get pretty good accuracy.
You'd probably have more historically correct.
Come to think of it.
Interestingly enough, you guys, the battle, the American troops, Custer's five companies and all the rest, had like two particular weapons, okay? The Indians had, are you ready for this, 31 different kinds of weapons, including repeaters.
So, anything they could get.
Yeah, and
there was even a blunderbuss that was discovered later on. But you know, here were Custer's troops with breech loading rifles, and of course the old, which is commonly known as the Colt 45, which was a new issue. It was called an Army issue at the time. The gun that won the West, whatever you want to call it, they had that. But what good would that do them at a distance? And it's like I don't know what it means, but like I said, when they had that fire in the Little Bighorn like 30, 40 years ago, they found a lot of casings and shell fragments, so they got to reposition everybody by empty casings and all that kind of stuff.
And they were scattered all over the place.
Oh, yeah, and it was a really fascinating study. I talked to one of the Rangers when I was there last, six, 7 years ago. But it was like, this was an amazing, amazing thing, because the Indians had all kinds. They had repeaters as well, by the way, lever action stuff. And here, it's like, that's the side I didn't see. So I'm interested in what your take was and what Redford presented.
I didn't get up to the Little Bighorn fight. I just got all the stuff up to the historic part, up to the Black Hills mission, where you've got a secretive president along with General Sherman bringing in General Custer and telling him, we know there's gold in there. Well, they didn't know there was gold in there.
Black Hills, yeah.
Yeah, the Black Hills thing. They said, hey, here's what we need you to do. We need you to map this, because we don't know what the hell it is.
They wanted to
but
build
while
some
you're
forts.
There, if you find some gold, let us know, will you? We could use it. That's essentially the, and I don't know if you know this book or not, it's your neighbor, Terry Mort, over in Sonoyta. Thieves Road, The Black Hills Betrayal and Custer's Path to the Little Bighorn. Good, solid book written about 2 years ago. And
you think if Custer had lived, he could have become the Hillary of his day?
Oh, my. We're segueing on a heavy matter here.
Well, because I was thinking about the politics that were involved behind all of this that was going on with Custer and the Army in the West at that time.
I try not to dwell on it.
Okay.
No, and I think... there's two sides of this, as we all know who read a certain novel called Custer, Terry, and Me by our good friend. And another one, I find the best novel to give you the story of Custer is Greasy Grass by Johnny Boggs.
Well, I don't have that one, and I probably should, because I appreciate Johnny Boggs' writing. I've
What about the old one, maybe. Dorothy Miles Johnson, the day Custer died?
Let me tell you how that one starts off, and you'll get the idea. It's the 50th anniversary in 1926, and Libby Custer is sitting in a New York hotel room listening to it on the radio.
Hmm.
Which is, and at the end of that, you're not quite sure. Boggs is so good at going down the middle. You're not sure, but you do get everything presented. My point is, if you just want to do factual stuff, how hard is it to gather?
Well, you can get all the way back to Utley, who I've talked to
yes.
a few times. And there's a guy that wrote a lot of books, and he really, I must admit, he influenced me, and he influenced Glenn Boyer, who, by the way, was a pretty good customer expert himself.
That's why I brought up a certain novel.
And yeah, well, he was working on a novel when he died where Custer lived.
Oh, that would have been fun. There is one. There is one. It's called The Trial of George Armstrong Custer, remember?
But anyway, a guy named Jack Pennington wrote three or four books. And I thought, in my opinion, he nailed it. It's laborious reading. It's boring. He goes through all these details. But there's a conclusion that he reaches that is a bit unusual in the field. I won't bother to elaborate on that because I think I'm going to lecture on it next year. But the bottom line is, Pennington really kind of culminated all of Utley's and everybody else's stuff. So, but then yeah, there's so many people. So it's like the gunfight and Herbst. And there's, you know, tens of scores of guys have written about this stuff. And I'm not saying they're all wrong or right, but there's a few that, you know, there's a few that I embrace and the rest I discard.
Well, you know, something we haven't mentioned is that the way that movies have impacted the American psyche about these, you know, like, you know, they died with their boots on. So many people saw, even the people that didn't see it, you know, in our generation now today, the young people, but their parents and their grandparents have seen it, and they've perpetuated that Custer that they saw back in the 30s and 40s.
Errol Flynn.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but now you got the reverse of it, where he was nothing but a dirty, no-good Indian hater, which wasn't true.
I know, but this is the thing, though. There's a psyche that travels through culture, and I think some of that is the overflow of that over time. People don't even know. It's just part of what they know and believe.
You know what?
You know, you're right. And you know what impressed me is my reversal because of my study of history. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee is a complete damn fabrication.
Thank you.
D. Brown invented everything. There's a biography, an autobiography, and a testimony in front of the United States Congress given by a priest who was more than just friends of the Indian and was there on the ground. And he went and testified and said the Indian started, you know. But, you know, the book was written like 1969, 1970. The culture was different. You know, give me an anti-culturist, give me Dennis Hopper, or whatever you want. And this book just exploded, and it's remained unchallenged to this day. And to me, that's just absolutely amazing.
Yep.
Well, part of this is something you taught me, Mr. Dyke. Always remember when you're in a room full of people at a Rotary Club talking about anything to do with the West, that what the people in the room know never came out of a book. It came out of a movie.
Roy Rogers and Gene Autry.
Well, like, everybody saw either Tombstone or Wyatt Earp. Nobody got around to reading much of anything else.
Like My Darling Clementine.
So that's where and when you're discussing this with people...
Well, you're too old, Bunker. You call me back.
Thank you.
What are you going to do?
Both of your points is well taken.
Well, yeah.
Because people, as I've told and I've lectured with Emil and Bob Palmquist, I consider one of the ultimate ERP experts, is an attorney in town up there. And it's like, you know what? Forget about that. People want to be entertained, you know? But they want to be entertained with the truth. That's why they're coming.
Mm-hmm.
But you can entertain them anyway, and you don't have to slaughter everybody along the way, but, you know, just say, well, consider this, you know, and that's always been my approach with lecturing. It's just like, make sure that you get your viewpoint across and they can believe what they want to believe.
Well, I got one going, and that was when my good friend Michael F. Blake taught me when I was bitching about something in Tombstone. He said, Franzi, You want a documentary? Go to the History Channel. This is entertainment. Shut up. And I get that. All right. Now, we got about 2 minutes, and James from Prescott is calling. Hi there.
Yes, well, I'm in Prescott right now, but I live in Tucson. Hey, you know, I recently saw the documentary part called Killing Lincoln, which is loosely based on O'Reilly's book, but it was really researched on their own, and it was really fascinating doing the voice, listening to the voiceover with the director, just what kind of detail they went into, and it was amazing, and they would shoot a scene which had a controversy with some small detail, but they did things to leave it up to the viewer, because there was different people. So just to bring up the Lincoln thing, that has a whole lot of detail that so many historians over time, but so many times in the past, they didn't do a good job recreating it, and they went to extreme lengths to do a very good job.
I didn't see it. I will just throw this out there. I'm a graduate of Gettysburg College. And when I was there, they did the 100th anniversary of the battle. And I met Bruce Catton. And, so obviously, being loving history, I have a passing knowledge with Lincoln and everything else. But the bottom line, I didn't see this presentation. There's been so many thousand books written. But, he was, They named Billy the Kid was in a county they named after him, so he must have done something right.
Yep. All right. Well, the only thing I got to tell you is we're about out of time. For all of you, I haven't had anybody call up to say, wow, that really was cool, that Robert Redford stuff.
Nobody defended it, did they?
No. Well, it's because it sucked worse than anything I've ever seen on those scores of those pretentious, phony historical things. And if that's Bill O'Reilly stuff, has got to make him somewhere around Bruce Caton, okay?
Yeah, well, almost, but not quite.
All right, my friend. Thank you, Scott. Appreciate your time, buddy.
Bye, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Voices of the West.